It is Saturday, September 19th, 2009, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, geek news, and the second half, your questions and comments about technology.
The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is brought to you by GNI, GNIHosting.com.
It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed on GeekSpeak and during the show are not necessarily those of KOSP. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks. Al Luckow, he's a new media architect. Good morning, Al.
Hi, good morning, everyone.
Mr. Ben Jaffe, a freelance media guy.
Hey.
And Miles Elam, a student at UCSC. A slacker, a political junkie, an educator of sorts. Hi.
Good morning.
I got to say, Miles, it's been fun working together with you again. I get to see you more.
Really? I'm hardly ever there.
Sure. But me neither.
That's what he means.
So let's start up talking about robots because, well, they're fun.
Why not?
This one's not so much fun, though. This is kind of scary.
Yeah. I found this one in Wired's galleries of surgical robots. And it's known as Bloodbot.
Is this one of those ones that feeds on human blood?
Well, no, but it does involve blood. Bloodbot is the invention of the Mechatronics in Medicine group at the Imperial College of London. And it works by first scanning the inside of a patient's elbow using a pressure sensor that glides over the skin to detect the location of a vein.
Okay. What is
Step
it? Use?
One.
Then, switching to a syringe, the robot detects pressure changes. So when the needle punctures the vein, it knows when to stop. Something about the words that it knows when to stop that kind of make me feel a little scared.
I can use a subroutine in the application. You know, stop needle from penetrating.
I mean, and it's got to be holding your arm still to do this. So
yes.
It's basically a robotic phlebotomist.
Is that what they're called?
Well,
what is it called?
Phlebotomist.
Phlebotomist
is a person who takes blood out of...
So this can do it quickly?
Well, 78% of the time they say it's accurate.
See, the thing is, I see this... I have it envisioned in my head this Terminator-style machine coming over, grabbing your wrist. You're like, let me go.
Must draw blood from you. Please be patient.
What happens?
No, I was actually thinking more of an Arnold Schwarzenegger-style voice of, you must remain calm.
I don't know what it means, 78%, because does that mean the other 22%, it stabbed the patient in the eye or something? Sorry. I will try again.
Instead of pulling blood, like inserted oil. Yeah,
but then again, my experience with many nurses has been that a lot of some of them are very good and some of them miss veins all the time. Like we'll take 3 or 4 tries. So the fact that it has 78%.
Let's assume that it just doesn't hit the
You know, personally, I take a nervous nurse any day over the blood bot. I mean, why'd they call it the blood bot? Wait here, we're going to get the blood bot.
The thing with the nurse is you assume that the humanity will kick in at some point if failure happens enough.
Right.
Or you're too scared.
Well,
the nurse looks at you, you know.
You're in a lot of pain.
He'll look at you and go, this person looks a little too scared. Maybe we should talk a bit about something.
There's too much blood on the ground.
Yeah. Instead of just try again.
I will keep trying.
Try again.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a pretty...
That's great, though.
I have to say, Al, I can't imagine anyone... But you doing these robot stories, your delivery of these things is impeccable. It's just
you know what? I'm not even making anything up. It's just
okay. So with this blood bot, you would assume that the reason they're doing this is to get more efficient than a human,
right?
And to get better at it, so that you can draw blood more efficiently and all that. But isn't there an idea in medicine that you kind of do want human interaction? Like at what point? I think blood drawing is one of those ones where it's okay to have a conversation with someone who's about to take blood from you. It's very you know. It's very invasive.
Personally,
you know?
I like to be distracted when somebody takes blood.
I think if a Terminator robot walked into a room, you'd be really distracted.
Yeah, that's true.
Meet my friend.
All right. Let's talk about the wonderful education system in the United States, especially Oklahoma. Miles, fill us in how wonderful it is in Oklahoma. Oh, man. This is depressing.
Well, yeah, wonderful. Of course, you can hear from Lyle's voice's little tinge with irony.
Yeah, a little sarcasm.
A little bit of sarcasm there. Basically, what happened was a group got together, took a sample of high school seniors, individuals 18 years old, asked them basic questions. Basically, they provided them the citizenship test given to recent immigrants as part of their
to see the general knowledge of the federal government structure.
Right. How the U.S. government works, what the social structure is like, the basic history lessons.
Let's go ahead and do that. That test is only like seven questions, right?
It's 10.
10 questions.
And okay. You have to get at least 7 right to pass.
Okay. So who wants to potentially have to get kicked out of the U.S.? One of you guys want to take this test?
Well, I listened to a lot of Schoolhouse Rock growing up.
So you're going to be fine.
Ben, you're almost in high school, so.
Yeah. Let's see how it goes.
Oh, boy.
Let's see how it goes. First off, let's find out. How poorly did Oklahoma do, Oklahoma students?
Well, no, let's go through the test first.
Yeah? Okay.
I think it's better for
you play along at home. 10 questions about the federal government. If you don't get 7 of them right, you really should leave the U.S. Okay.
Right. What is the supreme law of the land?
The supreme law of the land?
Yeah.
It's not like a phrase.
The fact that you guys are taking a while is actually kind of bad.
It took me a second because I thought, well, wait, we don't have a constitution.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
Oh, thanks for answering
right.
it for me.
I answered
Maybe
it for
collectively
him.
We can all graduate from Oklahoma High. That would be okay with me.
I did miss one of these on the way in. Okay.
Right. 28% of Oklahoma
students got
students
that right.
Got that correct.
Okay.
28%.
On. But for me, when you asked that in the car, I was like, wait, are we looking for like a term?
That's like a trick question.
Yes, felt like
the term is called the Constitution.
No, but when you say the supreme law, it seems like a law rather than a document of law. It just is the way it was phrased.
You should have said
a little scared to answer that.
Right. It sounded like, yeah.
Like that's the answer I would have given, but I'm just like, this feels like.
Right.
So maybe that's what the.
It should
Oklahoma
say what's the document of law.
Then it would be. It's like saying what's the most important thing.
What's the supreme law? Yeah, that's pretty good.
The supreme law of the land is the Constitution.
Yeah.
That's
all
you've heard
all right.
of it.
Playing along.
What do we call the first 10 amendments to the Constitution?
The Bill of Rights.
Okay.
26% got that right.
All right.
What are the two parts of the U.S. Congress?
The two parts of the U.S. Congress?
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of the three
branches.
Branches.
Yep.
So we'll go a little longer.
There's the House of Representatives and the Senate.
There you go.
All right.
Oh, okay.
27%.
All right.
They're easier than you think they are.
Don't think about trick questions.
Yeah.
How many justices are there on the Supreme Court?
Roosters don't lay eggs. Oh, I was just thinking of trick answers. 10? 8.
Good.
You straddled it quite nicely. 9.
9 it is.
9, okay.
10% got that right.
Why do we need to know
that,
really?
Why is Ben being quiet?
Why does that matter? I mean,
because history is my worst subject.
You know what? You're not allowed to be in the U.S. You don't know how many Supreme Court justices there are.
The funny thing is, before we started the show, Miles, you said, what was it about the Supreme Court? You actually asked how many Supreme Court...
what's the number of Supreme Court justices as listed in the Constitution?
And Al, you kicked in with...
I said 0.
0, because you knew that. Yeah,
right, I knew that. But
because it is not listed in the Constitution.
That's
the
right.
fact that we have 9 is merely a historical artifact.
Well, and you're assuming we have 9. You don't know. Someone might have died in the last hour. You don't know.
Well,
so there you go.
I think you're 15 so smart,
minutes. Miles.
Anyway, overall, the score for U.S. students, including the fact that only 23% of them knew that the first president was George Washington, only 2.8% of the students scored well enough to be eligible for U.S. citizenship.
Only 3% of Oklahoma high school students know enough to pass that test.
Right, as found from a study done by the Oklahoma Council on Public Affairs.
We're going to go on to the next news story, but what were the other questions? We went with the Constitution. We went with the amount of Supreme Courts.
Who wrote the Declaration of Independence?
Okay, move on.
What ocean is on the east coast of the United States? What are the two major political parties in the United States? We elected a U.S. senator for how many years? And who was the first president of the United States? And finally, who is in charge of the executive branch?
Why don't you give me those easy ones?
Yeah.
Man, why are you giving me the hardest one? I could have got all of those.
They get easier. All right, let's go on. So that's sad.
Well, the thing is, We were picking on the Oklahoma high school students, but at the same time, we haven't done the study for all high school students. And yeah. Curious as to see what it is all around.
Ultimately, immigrants in this company that are in this country that have become nationalized are just more intelligent than than those of us who have born here.
Clearly.
About the government.
Right. There's a higher percentage also that start their own businesses, immigrants, versus people who were born here. There you go, because everyone knows that all the people that come in know that there's 9 Supreme Court justices. Right. All right. Moving on. Hey, Ben. How's it going?
Hi. I wanted to talk about a telescope, because I like me some telescopes.
Okay.
Planck Space Observatory has started to give back...
The satellite.
Yes.
That's a satellite telescope.
It is a satellite telescope. Actually, it is in the L2 Lagrange point, I think, which is the one just past the Earth in a line with the sun.
The simple way of describing what Ben just said is that there's gravitational points that are kind of neutral, and one is behind the Earth and one is in front, if you will. And so, it's kind of the triangular location between the Earth and the sun behind us gravitationally that causes kind of a well.
Yeah, so you can basically put something there and it will just stay there. Yeah, relative to it'll stay there.
And it's not really orbiting.
It's orbiting the sun, and the gravity of the Earth is keeping it stable with a faster orbit. Well, in any case. So really cool satellite or really cool observatory. And it's designed to measure cosmic microwave background radiation over the sky and very, very small variations in it. Right.
Right.
And so the idea is to kind of get an idea of how the universe started and, you know, very, very early in time kind of stuff, like beginning of. What I found really interesting about this, by the way, the news story today, it was launched back in May, and the news story today is that we've started to get data back, and it looks like it is working very, very well. So, and two things that are really cool about this is that one, of all these telescopes that I've covered over the last couple months, it's amazing that they can do something so complex and then it works exactly as it should or better, you know, and it's really incredible to me.
Engineers are cool.
They really, really work on it from an engineering perspective. It ends up really nice. Also, the other thing is that this is kind of similar to the Kepler Observatory, where it's looking for very small variations. In this case, it's looking for variations in the temperature of the microwave background. And the variations it's looking for are about 1,000,000 times smaller than 1 degree. And so in this article, they compare that to measuring from Earth the body heat of a rabbit sitting on Mars. Sitting on the moon, which is still ridiculous.
That's how sensitive this thing is.
It's amazing that we can get detectors that are this sensitive. Kepler was measuring the changed light output of the Earth if you were to turn on your porch light from orbit, right?
Right. That's amazing.
It's just amazing to me that we can create detectors.
And we talk about the background radiation, background noise radiation. At some point in the early universe, everything was kind of a uniform amount of energy before expansion really kicked in. And as it expanded, that uniform amount of energy decreased. And you can imagine it being extremely, extremely bright white light, right? But over time, we've expanded, and that light has actually decreased in its frequency because of its the expanse, until now we see it at a very low from a light perspective but high from a radio perspective amount of frequency, and that's kind of everywhere. It's in all directions. But the interesting thing is it's not perfectly the same. It's not uniform in all directions.
Exactly.
And that early makeup of non-uniformity or the modification of expansion, whatever it is that's causing that, is a really interesting thing to study because it potentially could show us why we have matter pockets like galaxies.
Yeah, it's called anisotropies is what it's looking for, and those are just the irregularities in the microwave.
I'm thinking
background.
Of like the difference clouds is what I always think about. Difference cloud in Photoshop.
Yeah.
The filter. That's what I always think it looks like.
Well, difference clouds and then levels
or it looks
like squish it.
Or it looks like Babylon 5's, what was Babylon 5's faster than light travel? What was that area called?
I have no idea. I never watched Babylon 5.
I just want to know how they got that rabbit on
the
moon.
How
long has it been up there?
Yeah, but they weren't. It wasn't called hyperspace, was it? In Babylon 5, what was the terminology for that other space that you traveled in?
So
and other questions can be answered at geekspeak.org.
Al, this is a make-believe rabbit, kind of like Schrodinger's cat. no cats were harmed in the.
Does the rabbit, so the rabbit might have been there, might not have been there?
Does the rabbit?
No, it's a theoretical rabbit.
If the rabbit's there, does it know it's there?
It's a mind experiment. So if a rabbit exists only in a mind experiment, does it really exist?
Does it really have heat on the moon?
Is it really sentient?
Moving on. Let's do a really fast round of mentions. We're going to start with Al.
Okay.
Just been quick.
What would you like me to mention?
Oh, military robot.
The military. There was a machine rebellion, and a killer robot was destroyed by a U.S. jet.
All right.
It was a rogue droid attempting to cross the border. It was in Afghanistan. It was in the 15th of September, and this American Reaper flying hunter killer robot assassin rebelled against its human controllers above Afghanistan.
When you say rebel, you mean it didn't do what it was supposed to do?
It didn't do what it was supposed to do. It started going over the border and going towards the wrong way, and it's got these it can carry up to 14 Hellfire missiles. It's not a thing you want to have flying around.
First off, this is not a mention. This is a discussion, but that's okay.
Well, it's just,
so.
I'm sorry. I can't help but interject. But this reminds me of Red Planet, I believe it was, that had the utility robot that went into combat mode.
Yes,
and it makes me think like when you're going on a trip to Mars to save the human race, wouldn't you think you would take out the chip that had combat mode?
Yeah. Just comment on that whole subroutine and recompile.
Well, at least this was a combat robot.
A combat robot that's always in combat mode, and instead of stopping and turning when it was told to, it kept flying.
It kept going, and it just
happened to be a military craft lots of ammunition and stuff, just going across borders, because what could happen?
So they had the opposite problem. It was like, no, I'm not going to do what I'm not doing what you're telling me. I'm going AWOL.
Well, they
fight the power.
They blew this thing up and it crashed into a mountain and nobody was hurt.
Oh, good. I'm so glad we're blowing millions of dollars.
Well, the robot was hurt, right?
Robot was hurt.
Yeah, yes. The robot was hurt a lot.
That was the objective.
All right, now we'll do a round of mentions. And Al, at the end of this mention round, you're going to cover the hopping robot, okay? So, Ben.
Oh, yes. So, quick mention. 178 years ago, Charles Darwin set sail in the HMS Beagle to do all of the work on the origin of the species. And it turns out now some British and Dutch scientists are resailing Darwin's original route during his voyage. There's this whole site that's set up. It's got a live feed. They're on Twitter. They're going to be on YouTube.
You can do it virtually with them?
It's awesome, yes. And but you need to be able to speak Dutch because that's what the site's in. So, sorry.
Virtual Beagle. Cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Miles?
The FCC, Federal Communication Commission, to introduce a net neutrality rule to have carriers force them to not play favorites over a particular protocol, like charge Google more to carry their content over the local carrier. And there is a bill going through Congress known as the Justice Act that would roll back telecom wiretap immunity, something that was passed a little while back under the Bush administration, to give retroactive immunity to any deeds that, for example, AT&T may have done and others. And so there's now an act to say, no, that never happened.
Good. So we actually might prosecute.
You'd be curious to see how that plays out with the Supreme Court as well. But
thank you very much. Al?
The hopping? A robot can hop over obstacles more than 7.5
meters
high, that which is
25 really
feet.
Yeah.
So this they came out with a robot. It can jump over these things. It looks kind of like a
RC toy
car.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a four wheels and drives around. Really, it looks like something that'd be kind of cool to have as a toy. But apparently it's a robot and it's designed for urban
investigations.
So it's but that one is we'll have the link to that on the website.
Right. And
it's video footage. We have video footage of this thing going.
That's right. You know? One thing I noticed about that is it seems to me like it's going to have a lot of pressure down. And I'm wondering if it's going to puncture the ground.
It's
or
a piston.
Yeah.
That hits it. Hits it. And it
that's
springs
what that is.
It up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I have one more quick mention, which is Programmer's Day is officially a professional holiday in Russia.
Hooray.
Hooray. Which is September 13th. Anyone get the reference of why it's September 13th? Here's a hint. September 12th, if it's a light year. Or if it's a leap year.
Is it 256?
Day number 256. Yes, indeed.
Cool.
Which is, of course, the maximum degree of two that can be expressed, which is less than 365. So, anyway.
Oh, I see.
So, so does this mean that we'll have all these other professional days? I don't know. But
wait, I'm sorry. It's September 20th?
No, September 13th.
Unfortunately. 13th. It was a few days ago.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Wait, 13th, no. 13th is if it's a leap year. September 12th is if it's not.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Anyway. So let's all celebrate.
All right.
Oh, too late.
Miles?
Wait, I'm sorry. Yeah. You'll have to explain that. How is
256 days? I don't know. I didn't do the math on it.
The 256th day.
In the year,
256th
yes.
day of the year.
Got it. Right. Okay.
Yes, indeed. I have this problem. I keep looking at the clock and seeing either 256 or 512 or 128. It's really strange.
You should get a new clock.
I don't know. Confirmation bias thing.
Miles. Quantum motors?
Quantum electric motors, yes. This coming from the online magazine Technology Review. It talks about taking a couple of atoms and or a few atoms, putting them into an alternating magnetic field and having them oscillate, basically making a small AC motor.
Why are we calling it a quantum motor? Because it's so small? Or because the oscillations is not in the...
Because it is acting upon the very small nuclear forces.
Right, okay.
I mean, about the motor consists of one neutral atom and one charged atom. Trapped in a ring-shaped optical lattice.
Okay, I'm impressed.
So, yes, that would qualify as a quantum motor.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. So does that mean that it wouldn't be good for a clock because it might rotate one direction, might rotate
another
direction?
Right, there's still research as to how to apply it.
Right.
But having the motor in the first place, having the motion, and it's a regular motion.
I guess I'm kind of excited anytime I think about engineering and quantum physics, if you will, because that issue is kind of problematic for me, like the idea of actually turning reality. People talk about quantum computing all the time, but I've yet to hear like really what a quantum computer would actually physically look like how you would make it. I hear about that.
People have made it.
I know, but I don't know much about like how you actually do it. So anyways,
I'm sure it wouldn't look all that exciting.
It'd be like, very small.
Modern computers tend to be fairly nondescript for what
yes, but I
doing.
Know how a transistor works. See, that's the thing. It's like from a base level, I know that, and then from logic gates, I understand that. Like, so I can take the base level and expand it, no problem. And then, but
well, I guess you just need to get smarter.
I think it's more education I need.
Apparently, kickstarting the motor requires some extra work. It says here,
change the polarity of Earth.
Some kind of asymmetry, which is provided by a combination of symmetry breaking driving field and the presence of a neutral atom, which the charge atom effectively pushes off against.
Oh, right, of course, yeah.
So basically, Star Trekian technology.
Yeah,
so
you get your buddies to jump out of the car, and they push from behind the car and tell you. Yeah.
Well, the neutral atom is that thing that it pushes up against, and
right.
Then the magnetic field keeps it in motion.
I had a question for you, Miles, because you like this kind of totally tangent. But if you're the designated driver, and your vehicle has like you left your lights on, right, and you've got like three people with you that are all drunk and they shouldn't drive, but you need to jumpstart your car, like push it. What is it called? Popping the clutch.
Mm-hmm.
Is that legal?
To have drunk friends to push your car?
Yeah, because they're moving a vehicle on a road.
They are not operating a vehicle, though.
But they're providing the power.
They're not operating it, though.
Okay.
Operating it involves the pedals, the steering wheel.
So you would say it's okay.
So can your engine be drunk?
Yeah,
a lot
exactly.
of engines run on alcohol. So, hey,
so it's
that's
okay.
perfectly legal.
Yeah.
Yep.
However, the motor is not intoxicated.
Well, I don't know about that.
God, you...
Moving on. It doesn't depend on its blood pressure. Oh, I see. It doesn't have a blood system.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have a robot that instead of draws blood, runs with a blood system.
Runs on blood?
Then it could get drunk.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yes.
We'll probably be
Data got drunk and he didn't have blood.
Data got drunk?
I don't know what he had.
Well, he got intoxicated, yeah. Come on.
Which episode?
Oh, come on.
How
it's like
can
the
I
fourth
not
episode. It's the episode when they're in a really high gravity well and everyone gets intoxicated and Data and Tasha Yar kind of get to know each other. Come on.
Oh, that one.
Yeah, he's intoxicated.
My God.
I don't know. I don't know if I would call that intoxicated.
He calls it intoxication.
Huh. Are you
he says,
sure?
I don't know the exact quote, but yeah.
I'm going to look it up
right now.
We'll
look it up right now. Jeez, you're the one that's supposed to be the expert on this kind of thing. But you know what? Okay, I'll skip you then.
We'll I'm ashamed to say that was the second episode, I believe.
Yeah, it was a recent episode. It had to be a recent episode because she died in the 14th or something.
Well, no, not recent.
No, I mean early episodes.
Yeah, I think it was like the second one.
Because she died in the first season, right?
She kept coming back as a ghost, though.
That's true. She came back. That episode, so she comes back, and Worf's not there because everybody's in a war scene. That's a great episode.
Okay, now that we've lost half our audience.
You're listening to Geek Speak on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me, I have Ben Jaffe and Al Luckow and Miles Elam. Ben, say hi.
Hello.
Al?
Hello.
And Mr. Miles Elam.
Good morning.
Ben, did you look it up?
I'm ashamed to find that, yes, indeed, it was The Naked Now, which was that episode, and it's Polywater, which is apparently, according to memorybeta.wikia.com, the Star Trek Wikipedia, it's a form of water that blah, 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 and Data got intoxicated.
The important part of that is that the water gets formed only in high-end gravitational wells.
Wait,
really?
Hold on, which episode was that? Yeah. Which number?
Which number?
That was episode number... Hold on. Oh, episode number 103. Not the second episode, the third episode.
Wait, it's actually the fourth episode, because this pilot isn't counted as zero.
What, define pilot? What do you mean by the pilot?
The pilot where other people are in it. Yeah, like completely, Pike's the
That's like episode negative one or something. I don't know.
Which is the greater dork? The one that goes for which episode it is or which season, or the one that gets it wrong?
Moving on. That's just the mystery of the universe we will never solve. Al, is it the future yet? Do we have flying cars? Because you have a little mention about air cars. So.
Oh, yeah. There's a company that has finally, for a long time, engineers have been trying to develop a car that runs on air. And now there finally is one that is getting ready for market, and it's going to be it's recently slated for production. It's the partner that signed with it is Tata. It's India's largest automotive manufacturer. I don't know how they came up with that name, Tata,
because it sounds great.
It's yeah, it's my car. The
is
Tata.
There a pronunciation guide there?
Tata. It just looks like Tata.
But, oh, you're right.
Yeah.
But do you say it like a 3-year-old?
Because that's it just sounds like you'd say it that way.
Ta-ta. All right. It's probably ta-ta.
Ta-ta. I don't know. But it runs on compressed air and offers zero pollution and very low running costs. It's got microcontrollers all over it, controlling every little tiny piece. It's called the Mini Cat. But it has a weird spelling, so it's Mini C dot A dot T. A light urban car with a tubular chassis that is glued, not welded, and it's got a body of fiberglass. The heart of the electronic and communication system on the car is a computer offering an array of information reports that extends well beyond the speed of the vehicle. So it's got GPS, fleet management stuff, emergency systems. You know, it runs on compressed air. It seems like a pretty good idea. I don't know how far it goes. They don't really get into that. It was in Business Week, so it's obvious it's not some crazy, goofy thing that's in, you know, some site that's making stuff up. So
it's very cool.
Yeah.
All right, we didn't talk about a podcast, so I'm going to mention a great podcast called Escape Pod. And since you talked about compressed air, one of the episodes I loved, I don't know which episode of Escape Pod it actually is, but the actual story that I'm thinking about is called Exaltation. Do you recall this episode, Al? It's about the robot universe that all runs on compressed air. And so there's all these robots around and they're trying to figure out what's going on, and they live in a universe of compressed air. And it's called Exaltation, and it's by...
Is it recent?
I wouldn't say. I don't know. Exaltation by Ted Chiang.
Huh.
And it looks like it's probably Escape Pod 194. Yeah, it's Escape Pod 194.
Fairly recent,
but it's great sci-fi like idea. Like, you know, the new universe. It's all but there's
Escape
Pod pressure differential.
It's such a great collection of sci-fi short stories. If you're not listening to it, you're really missing out.
Especially if you're listening to us instead of it.
Maybe we shouldn't say that.
Oh, I'll edit the podcast.
You should listen to us, and then when you're done with us, Escape Pod.
All right. I'm not done with us. We got more news stories, and we probably have calls coming in. We do.
That what that red blinking light
the
means?
The red blinking light means that we have someone on the phone, which is something most podcasts can't do, and we can, which is always
awesome.
It
doesn't mean fire.
I don't think so.
Okay.
All right. Good. I actually know who it is now. This is good. I like knowing that before we welcome them on air. From Santa Cruz, Dave, welcome to Geek Speak.
Oh, hi. I was over in the Apple Store yesterday, and last week you talked about installation of Snow Leopard, and you said that it would go to the default and install 32-bit architecture, but apparently they said over there that's not the case, that if you have dual Intel processors, which all machines have nowadays, I guess.
Yeah, the newer Macs do have this.
And it automatically installs 64-bit. You don't have to change any settings.
So I remember what I said was that most of Snow Leopard is 64-bit. What I had read was that the kernel by default boots into 32-bit. I'm not sure.
So what you're saying is that it does install the 64-bit version, but it might not boot off the 64-bit
version. I didn't mean to say that there was a 32-bit and a 64-bit version necessarily, but just that the kernel itself runs in 32-bit.
No, you'd have to ship two different kernels.
Well,
I don't know of any technical way that you could have a kernel simultaneously do both and have it be efficient. And
I think what Ben's saying, though, if you buy the system and you install it, you do have both kernels in your system.
And both of them are installed at the same time.
They can both be installed at the same time. You're just switching which one you're using.
Right.
Yeah, anyway, you don't have to change any settings in machines if you have these dual Intel processors.
Okay, so the thing is, is this the Genius Bar that told you this, or is this just the peon walking around the store? Because those are different people. when you claim you're a genius.
They had to scurry around a while,
I'm not sure I agree with their assessment. I mean, I get that they work there and they're geniuses, but Miles, if you have a 64-bit kernel, well, no, they could be running stuff in emulation mode. I mean, it would be fine to boot in that kernel. So Ben, your story's been questioned, which means you have to look it up and find out if you were right or if the geniuses at the Apple Store are right.
Indeed.
And if you are right, Ben, well, you'll have to work at Apple Store. Well, thank you, Dave, for the clarification and correction of our story. I appreciate it. Did you get a new machine?
Already had one. Anyway, takes an hour to install this program, so you have to wait around a while.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much for the call. Bye-bye.
Took a night for yours, didn't it, Lyle?
It took. At first it said it was going to take 14 hours, and then it took like 6. Or 4. But then again, I've got lots of data and lots of applications and servers running, and it migrated everything for me. My PostgreSQL database is fine. It was just really cool.
So I just looked up the kernel in the frameworks panel in System Profiler on my Snow Leopard installation. I have a Core 2 Duo, Intel Core 2 Duo, and it says that it's not running in 64-bit. So actual kernel itself, I guess, runs in 32-bit, at least for the moment.
As much as the Apple staff at those stores are freaking fantastically cool, I can imagine they got it wrong.
Wait, I thought that you had said if you were booting up and you press the 6 and the 4 key, then you have a 64-bit kernel.
Yes, but I don't hold down those keys when I try on my computer.
Right, both of them are available. Both of them are installed.
By default, it boots into the 32-bit kernel. At least that's what my computer here is telling me.
How am I checking this?
If you go to System Profiler, then you click on Frameworks. It's at the bottom of the left-hand pane under Software, Frameworks.
Then
it takes a few seconds to load up the list of frameworks, and you click on Kernel. But anyway.
All right, well, I'll let you know about what mine's doing. All right, thank you very much for that. As we wait for the calls to be plugged into us, let's go ahead and do another story. Let's see where we are in the lineup. I believe Pictures from Space, Ben.
Okay. I was going to say, if you're a MacGyver sort, what can you do with the following items? A huge balloon, a parachute, a prepaid cell phone, a beer cooler, some duct tape, zip ties, a camera, insulation material, a Duracell USB phone charger, a hand warmer, and 4 AA batteries.
I know what I can do with the beer cooler.
Anyone? No? Turns out you can... Are you ready for the answer?
Well,
the
time in Vegas?
Yeah, that's true. You can take pictures from space, very, very, very high in the atmosphere.
You didn't mention anything in the balloon.
Camera. He said
camera. Oh, helium. You're right.
Okay, you need helium. Without helium, you couldn't get into space.
Oh, that's a good point. I know. Man. So MacGyver would not be able to do this.
No, but he could probably pull helium out of like something.
Light.
So anyone who doesn't already know, anyone would guess how much that all costs to take really awesome pictures from space?
I'm going to guess it's under $1,000.
$148.
Whoa. So everyone here can do that?
Yeah, I really want to do it.
Okay, but it's $148 plus 7 years of your life doing it, right?
Some MIT students. Two MIT students did it.
How much does an MIT education cost?
A lot of money. Good point. That's a good point. So it really costs a lot. But
wait.
That part's expensive.
No, you could borrow the students.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you don't have to pay them much.
I you don't have to be a student. I don't know. Apparently miles above the Earth, they had some really awesome pictures.
That's very cool.
Was that in the Mercury just
I saw that.
Actually. I don't know if it was on the Mercury.
I saw a picture of it in the Mercury, and it was Look, you can see the curvature of the Earth in blackness, like with space and blue ground.
Very cool.
They have extrapolated. Oh, they have a GPS device also connected to it, and they have extrapolated that it reached an altitude of 18 miles before it returned to Earth, and GPS kind of stopped working once they got up that high.
Yeah.
But you know, based on the amount of time it was ascending before it started descending, everything.
Awesome.
Really, really cool stuff.
Miles, do you have anything to add, or do you just want to talk about apps?
No, I'm fine with talking about apps.
Let's do that.
There's an item called apps.gov. This is one of the first responses or the first manifestations of the fact that the country has a CTO for the first time.
Chief Technology Officer, cabinet-level position.
Yes.
Go on.
That there is a new website called apps.gov, and this is being put forth to say that every app that is listed in it's an online it looks very much like what you would expect from any online retailer, except that it's selling cloud computing, meaning services online for being able to do office productivity or social networking, things of that nature. And the idea is that every app that's in there has been certified for use with government agencies, which means the government agency doesn't have to go and check around. And it's just as soon as you go there, you know that it's been certified already. It's ready for use. I mean, assuming you're not using, you know, classified information.
Right.
And in this way, as long as you have the budget for it, if you're a government agency, you can go in there, do your thing. It reduces the amount of paperwork.
Right.
Saves a whole bunch of money.
And the social media apps area actually just shows the contract and the relationship to apps that we know really well, like WordPress, which is a website and also an application. You can enroll, and that's a free service. Add this. It's a bookmarking thing, a link. Publishers and bloggers spread their content. We've got Cool Iris, which is a great photo viewing thing. And then we start walking into like the social networking stuff, FriendFeed, MySpace, Facebook, Twitter Vid, all these are services that you can sign up as if you're a federal government branch or whatever. You sign up for this, and the contract has already been figured out from the federal government to this company to provide the services. And doing it this way, it's valid. So instead of just going, well, let's just make a MySpace page for this little branch of an office, you actually go through this, and you're doing it the correct way.
So this is a government agency that's saving money?
Yeah.
Which government
Actually, it's not a particular government agency. This is a pan-agency initiative. So this is for most branches of the government. A federal government worker could go in and do this.
And it's actually run right now under the U.S. General Services Administration group.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool stuff.
Right.
Flickr's up there too.
And one anecdote that was put in was there was an agency that wanted to put up a blogging tool for their employees, for the group, and put in the infrastructure and get all the stuff together. They were saying about $260,000.
Or you click this little button over at
Feenster. But one of the things one of the criticisms that came up having the CTO was he was looking at different areas and going, wait a second, why are you spending that much money when Blogger is free, when things like that are free?
When WordPress, very cool. So again, that's apps.gov. If you're involved in the federal government, I guess any government agency, you can use these
federal
services.
Federal government agency,
right, so you might have other state rules that would restrict you from using this, but it's apps.gov. Very much. Thank you. Thank you, Miles, very, very much for that. I think we're going to go ahead and take another call. And I just want to mention that the geeks today are, that was Miles Elam speaking. I'm Lyle Troxell. We also have Ben Jaffe and Al Luckow. In just a minute, Al's going to talk to us about Facebook, kind of. Oh, so sad. But first, let's go to Santa Cruz and talk to Hal. Hal, welcome to Geek Speak. Hello, Hal.
Good morning.
Hi. So first we have Dave, now we have Hal. Okay. I'm feeling all right. What's your question today?
I had Skype open, and I got a contact from Skype that said it had all kinds of dire warnings. It was from Detect Online. Windows requires immediate attention, and it says Security Center's detected malware on your computer.
If it's from Skype, it's spam.
And then it gives a URL, tells you should download a patch from this address, and the URL's protectsys.net.
Mm-hmm.
I I clicked on it, but it started doing a lot of stuff, and I immediately shut down. And now I've done a little searching online to see what's known about it. And
well, here's my non-professional expertise on this issue. Skype's trying to make money with advertising, and they're going to do pop-up alerts and things like that. And one of their advertisers is this company that wants to sell you a product. Their way of selling to you, I think, is a little sleazy. They're basically scaring you into buying it.
Well, they aren't selling anything.
Well, when you click on the link, they're getting... The bottom line is you're never going to get a warning about your system from Skype, ever.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Skype will never, ever send you something that tells you...
No, Skype didn't send it.
Oh.
It came from...
Account.
Somebody who...
Skype account. Someone sent a text message.
Yeah.
So in any case, this company... So it's not even an advertiser. It's just someone spamming you, spamming your account. Instead of sending you an email...
No, I'm not concerned about spam. I'm concerned about malware or something.
Right. So let me walk you through this a little bit. So first off, the trigger to try to get you to install stuff was spam. So first off, you clicked on that. The next step is most likely... they're not going to be able to do anything until you kind of walk through the process. They're going to try to get a trust level until you install like an ActiveX component, and then they might either they're installing malware or they're installing something like a virus. But when you say a whole bunch of stuff started to happen, can you describe what started to happen when you visited that website?
I'm afraid I can't. As soon as I saw a lot of activity, was like the old spam email from Outlook. I just detected something was going on I didn't want there.
Okay, so are you using Windows?
Yes.
And you're on Firefox or Internet Explorer?
I use Thunderbird, and I have AVG antivirus.
Okay, you're probably pretty good. I would assume that you're relatively safe. The URL that you went to, you could do some searching on that, which sounds like you did.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would definitely do a full scan of your system with AVG.
I've done that now.
You're probably okay. They probably were going to try to trick you into okaying their software install, right? By saying, yes, we do have malware. Go ahead and click yes next, and it's going to pop up.
Yeah, I think what it was doing was pretending to find bad stuff in my computer.
Right, and that was all fictitious, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'd agree with it, and I think you're probably okay. You probably didn't need to shut down. You probably could just kill the browser or shut down the browser.
But a good instinct to just stop it.
Yeah, another one to do next time you're concerned about that is disconnect your internet connection, but don't turn off your computer. Because once you disconnect your internet connection, they can't talk to you, can't do any more stuff.
Right.
And you can start working on your machine, because shutting down your computer quickly or like depowering it isn't actually very good for the system. I mean, shutting down is fine, but if a service already started installing an application, it's gonna hold your shutdown. So that doesn't really do anything. So powering it off would be the way to stop the process completely.
Well, I had a lot of stuff open, and I didn't have any problem when I rebooted.
Yeah, so, you're probably good, Hal. Thanks for the call. Take care. Yeah, be very skeptical when you get any kind of message from someone. Spam, we're all pretty familiar with, but these other services, chat applications and stuff, they can send a message from some generic person as well trying to install stuff on your system. So be really careful about that. Okay, so we talked about apps.
Actually, can I make a quick correction?
Please.
I had mentioned that the U.S. CTO was involved. It's actually the U.S. CIO, Chief Information Officer.
And I said Chief Technology Officer.
I had said that, and you were pointing it out. So quick correction.
So... the federal government has a program to give away things like Facebook accounts and such. So let's talk about Facebook. Are people using it?
Well, people are using it, and it's starting to control their lives. I mean, I use Facebook, and I update things and do things like that. But you know, it starts to get into your skin. And I ran across a couple of stories that are very good examples of how much power this is actually taking over for people. For example, in Adelaide, Australia, two girls were trapped in a storm drain, and they felt that it was more important to update their Facebook page and talk about what's happening to them rather than to call their, 000, which is the equivalent of 911 there.
So they got trapped. They had their cell phones.
Yep.
They were scared and trapped, and so they updated their Facebook entry saying,
They update their status instead of calling for help. Yeah, that's one example.
How did they get out?
They ended up getting help, and
it was 9 hours later, though.
Yeah, so
seriously?
Yeah, that's what I heard on what's that news show that's 2 hours after us?
Sure.
Wait, don't tell me.
Okay, 9 hours later.
It's funny. People are not thinking. And here's another example of this burglar was arrested. He broke into somebody's house And, oh, there's a computer there. Well, I got a minute. He checked his Facebook page on the computer of the person he was burglarizing. And then, you know, got to get out of there quick because you're a burglar.
You got to leave.
Yeah. Got out of there, stole the stuff and left, but so, didn't log out of his Facebook account. So he was caught, actually.
Awesome.
And that
really?
Was, yes. That was actually in, let me make sure I can attribute that.
Dumb crime does not pay.
Well, we'll have it on. It's in Pennsylvania. A Pennsylvania man. Thank you.
It's up on geekspeak.org. Yeah. All right, cool. Thank you very much. Yesterday, Miles, we found out from students of ours about a very cool addition to HTML4 or HTML5.
Oh, no, that was me.
That was you?
Yeah, that I found out about it.
No, student. Oh, that's right. The student told us about something else. Okay, so you told me. Sorry. Mm-hmm. You're not a student of mine.
It's a technology known as WebGL. It's taking OpenGL to web browsers.
Oh, geez. So what's OpenGL?
OpenGL is a graphics library commonly used for 3D graphics. Games like Quake were written in OpenGL, things like that.
So it's a 3D system that actually...
3D and 2D.
3D and 2D. It's a drawing system basically for your computer that can use these... And all the video cards, high-end video cards we talk about a lot, they can run that stuff really fast.
Have acceleration for OpenGL.
So the parallel processors in the graphics units can actually run OpenGL in this really great way, and therefore you can do amazing stuff with it. And Al immediately said, cool, because, of course, when you say WebGL, that means that in a web browser, you can do OpenGL.
Which means you don't have the separate installation step. You don't have, you know, it doesn't matter if you're on a Mac or a PC or Linux or right. anything like that.
And that means that we can start doing, and so how is it implemented in HTML? Web geeks.
It's using currently I downloaded a most recent Firefox Nightly that has a demo of it, a very simple one. That it's using a canvas tag,
mm-hmm.
and then you're wrapping it in a GL object.
Cool. So the canvas tag is actually a new thing in HTML4?
HTML5, I think, was canvas tag, but I'm not sure. Canvas came out, might have been before.
You can kind of think of canvas as kind of equivalent to drawing ability in Flash, but not exactly, and in JavaScript. So you would be able to do 3D rendering and actually high-end 2D render, like stuff with a lot of processing power, mm-hmm. in browser using JavaScript as the control language.
Yes.
That's really cool.
Most OpenGL programs today are written in C, C++, things like that. So time will tell whether JavaScript will have the horsepower to do it, but JavaScript's been getting much faster in browsers, and computers have been getting much faster.
And
so,
speaking of horsepower and JavaScript, the thing we did learn from the student was that there's a emulator in pure JavaScript of NES.
Nintendo Entertainment System.
Yeah. So,
a fully functional NES emulator.
Ben, you get
in
that?
In a web browser.
Yes.
All NES games you can play in browser just in JavaScript. It's a full JavaScript implementation.
No.
If you're using Chrome. Chrome's fast enough. Nobody else is fast enough.
No
That's
way.
Why, at least.
Very That's cool amazing.
Stuff. And assuming you're running a decent speed laptop or desktop computer.
Right. Of course. All right.
So my little netbook wouldn't be able to handle it.
No. No. Any more short mentions that we can cover? We don't have a lot of time, but... Got Programmer's Day, Military Robot Hops.
Restaurant with the...
Go for it.
There's a restaurant, and it's in London. It's called the Umnamu Asian Fusion Restaurant. And what it does is it has projectors above all the tables that project down a computer screen onto the table, and it's touch sensitive. So you can actually move things and make your orders and all different kinds of stuff right on the table itself. And you press a button or, you know, a projected button and see the chef cam. You can change the tablecloth by doing things. So basically, there's all these projectors above, and you can interact with the screen within the projector. It's a really cool kind of way to have a restaurant, if you ask me. And plus, you know, since nothing is on the table, you can clean them easily because it's just a projected image. And that's in London.
Very cool.
Gene Roddenberry's original Mac Plus is being auctioned off, which is pretty cool.
His first Mac Plus, is it still running?
I don't know.
How much did he type on that with that?
I'm not really sure.
And Gene Roddenberry is, of course,
Star Trek dude. Serial number ends with 0001, but that doesn't actually mean it was the first one manufactured. But it's pretty cool looking.
Wait, it's actually 001?
The serial number is F4200NUM0001, which makes it look like it's the first one that was manufactured, but it's not necessarily.
It's the first one of a particular production run, probably.
It's a nice number to have.
Who here had a Mac Plus?
I think we all had Mac Pluses. You had to boot from the disk.
Well, I don't think Ben did. I don't think
I'm too
live.
Young.
Yeah.
I did.
I was born after the Mac Plus came. No, that's not true.
weren't born after the Mac Plus. When were you born?
I don't know. I don't remember. It was so long ago.
But the Mac Plus, you had to put the cartridge, you had to put the floppy in to boot off. So it didn't have a brain in it. So you had to put the brain in.
Was that a floppy?
So your application and your system and everything was on the floppy. So you put the floppy in and then boot it up.
It's true. That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. And I remember trying to take a system disk and adding a couple applications to it so that it was big enough so I wouldn't have to switch it. Yeah, it was very cool stuff. All right, that's a little bit of nice little history of GeekSpeak stuff. In just a second, we're going to have a wonderful USB update.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission.
Hello, everybody. Al here, bringing you GeekSpeak's crazy USB device of the week. Now, I'm sure a lot of you out there work in office environments.
I believe you have my stapler.
Maybe it's not the most stimulating place to spend 8 hours of your day. And if you work at a computer all day, sometimes it becomes hard even to stay awake. Well, I found a crazy USB device designed to cure this little problem. It's called the Visomate. This thing connects through USB and sits on top of your monitor. It watches your head so that when you start to slump or fall asleep, it sends out a buzz to wake you up. Now, I set it up on all our computers here at GeekSpeak. So go ahead and plug them in, guys. So what it's doing is it sends out an invisible signal to find out when you might be dozing off or falling asleep.
I'm sorry.
Ben, I pay attention. No, as I was saying, Miles.
Okay.
Come on, guys. Let's wake up and pay attention now. Come on.
Al. Ooh,
sorry, I got tired myself there.
What?
Lyle.
What?
Ben. Miles.
Yeah.
Who's this?